Well, hello, gorgeous. We are back at it again.
Give them Lala with Randall.
Dude, exciting things today.
Well, first of all, it is a season finale of Vanderpump has happened.
Yes.
It's over. Let's just take a minute and celebrate that you just rocked 20 episodes of Vanderpump Rules. Yes!
Yay! Yeah!
Okay, now I'm going to interview you for a second.
Okay.
How do you feel about your season?
I feel absolutely epic.
You do?
Yeah, because like, you know, here's the thing. And I'm going to really make this short and sweet.
You got the hands up, so I definitely think it's going to be
intense. We're flailing.
It's going to be intense.
For me, Vanderpump Rules is very much real life, correct? That's our real lives.
Correct.
However, the show is 1 hour long. It is a produced show. So for me, when I have my freakouts or my meltdowns or I have a really great scene, like however I feel about it,
right,
I disconnect because I'm like, if I take this home with me,
right,
I'll crawl into a hole.
No, if you, first of all, we'll back up. Years before when yes, we first started dating, you did take this shit home with
yeah,
you and it was World War III.
Right.
What I'm most proud of is that it really is your real life and it kind of all blends together. But I think that when you have tough scenes where it gets like a little tough for you,
yeah,
I think you're able to disconnect now.
And well, you have to.
Yeah.
And when I watch it, when I have to like relive it, I sit there and I'm like, fuck, this is entertaining. You know, like, wow, look at me go.
I feel the same way.
And then when it's like great and I should probably apologize. But in order for me to maintain like sanity, I have to just look at it and be like, damn, that's so entertaining. Like, we did a great job. You know, that's how you have to look at it or you're going to freak out.
Well, now that Estasi calls me Bravo Liberty, I'm yes, going to say that I just had a season of Vanderpump as well. So I have something to contribute. I, after my first scene coming out of the gate, had to let it go too, because I felt that they made me look like I am the only person eating at that dinner when I had a double chicken sandwich.
Oh, wow. You're really throwing it back to like episode four.
Well, I only had like two episodes the whole season. So let me just revel in my one. First yeah, of all, I did order two chicken fucking sandwiches. And second of all, I'll order two more again. And by the way, y'all ate two. Why right, was it only me? Why was it only Randall?
Because it's entertaining. Like that scene, there are memes about it.
There's like slow motion of me eating chicken sandwiches.
Yeah, which keep in mind, I ordered like five dishes that night.
Wait, by the way,
I went ham.
You?
When I know production is paying, I'm like, bring them out. Give me all the goodness on the menu.
By the way, you, Jax, and Brittany ordered multiple dishes, and I was a slow motion chicken sandwich eater. It's a bunch of bullshit. I also want to say that the end of the season was very...
Yeah, why are you asking me how I feel about it? How do you feel about it? Your first time ever appearing on Vanderpump Rules, which I literally told everybody that will never happen. Never.
By the way, I told everybody it will never happen.
And not you're only did it happen...
You're a manipulator.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I do reality TV. No one is safe.
And you also gave me that bullshit when you're like, you know, this is my real life and like we need to show this side. And I said, you know that's not happening. You said... And then you gave me that look, like give me right now, and then I folded folded.
Folded
just
like a envelope, licky lick, throw a stamp on it, deliver it to Vanderpump Rules.
But I will tell you, I didn't film a lot, obviously. I did a
you
little
You didn't,
bit.
But it was hardcore. You had a scene with James Kennedy. You're like, not only am I gonna film now, I'm gonna have a scene one-on-one with James Kennedy.
No, hold on a second. I got trapped. They called me, your little producers.
Trapped.
Well, they're big producers, but your big producers called me and they said, will you show up at the season finale? And I said, there's no reason for me. I'm not relevant to this. I'm just gonna stay home, let Lala do her thing. They said, no, you gotta be there for her. It's the last night. We're gonna celebrate. It's a big party. So I come. I get wasted. I'm having the time of my life. And by the way, I bring Emma, Martin Scorsese's partner. So
no big deal.
And she's a fangirl of the show. So she's going crazy, taking selfies. And we're having the best time. So
right.
I think this is easy. They're focused on you guys. I'm over in the corner with Emma drinking. And all of a sudden, I get a little tap, tap. And they say, Randall, will you come over here for a second? We just need to shoot one little thing with you. I was like, oh, this is a goodbye, Randall, or something like that. Or maybe they want me to eat a chicken sandwich again. Long story short. Well, I was going to order a chicken sandwich because I thought they'd want a slow motion shot.
Right.
So they bring me over and there's James. They say, James wants to say something to you. And I'm like, these fucking people are good.
They're so good.
So, but having said that, now I'm going to be the serious side. James was sober and he came over to me and he was beyond sincere and very genuine. And it was so endearing. And he said, you know, I want to apologize for all the things I said and did. It wasn't in my right state. It doesn't make it okay. Will you forgive me? And I said, dude, that is such a big step and so big of you to do that. Of course I am. I know my fiance, you know, and you are very good friends, and I want to have the same friendship. And the fact that you did this is so honorable. And I forgive
you. You were
him.
Great, Rand.
I don't know. And I forgive him. And you know what? Since then, since he's been on our podcast and we text each other here and there, and it's like, you know what? He has come so far, and you know, life is about forgiveness. You know, we've forgiven each other for shit, and we forgive people for doing things to us that maybe, you know, aren't the kindest. And at the end of the day, I'm glad I went to that party. I'm glad I went to that final taping or filming, whatever you call it. And it was very sweet. And I watched the episode, which I don't watch a lot, you know. And the ending was exciting.
It was like exciting.
The music and the exit and Jax and Lisa going at it. I loved it.
We broke the fourth wall on Vanderpump Rules. Like, yeah. Jax goes crazy and he's talking to Lisa Vanderpump and he's like, this is my show. And she just was like, oh, it's your show. Vanderpump Rules. That's my name. Blah, blah. Like, it was crazy. It was amazing. The first finale episode I've ever gotten teary-eyed with.
Oh, when you watched it?
Yeah, I thought it was really sweet.
I loved it. I loved the music. I loved how each person or each couple kind of, or each cast member walked out.
Hold on, I have a really fun fact though. So that night, Danica gets into a little scuffle with like this new person that hooked up with Max. Her name's Kara. And Danica shoves Kara and Danica spills her wine on my outfit. Okay? And in the interview process, they wanted me to talk about the outfit because in their mind, it was like some fabulous outfit. Okay. I was like, I'm not going to talk about it because that outfit cost me all of like maybe $100 for the whole thing. So like, we're not talking about it. No big deal. You know, throw it in the wash. It's all good. Exactly. Like I'm a pretender. People think I'm a bougie bitch, but hell no. I am scrolling the internet for a good deal. What's happening?
Sorry.
Wow, Randall. Are you for real?
No, I was trying to do something that you wouldn't really
pull
like.
It together.
No.
Yes.
I had to play this.
Hold on. Get it to the chorus.
It's coming.
Turn it to the chorus.
How do I? It's coming.
Hold on. It's coming. It's coming. We're free. Yes. Hold on, wait for it.
Here it comes, so my good. Favorite part.
Here it is. Ever young, put a boom. You know that it's our time. These are the best days of our lives.
I mean, now I'm a cast member.
Your glass is high. This one's for you tonight. Boom.
Okay.
Dude, it did make me happy. It did make me happy.
How great is that?
You know what? We are fucking young, wild, and free, man.
Yeah.
Well, you know, well, we may have birthdays that make us older.
For one of you. You guys are young, wild, and free.
You're young, wild, and free, too. Age is just a number. I don't believe in celebrating a birthday to be like a year older.
You're
it's
right.
Like, no, we're celebrating this day because without it, I wouldn't exist.
I got to tell you, 8 years.
So you're freaking welcome. You know,
tell you, 8 years you were on this show so far.
Only five. I've completed five seasons.
But the show, 8 years. What an epic run so far. And I know you guys are going to go into your ninth season. So I got to give you this episode.
I love that you said you know that we're going into our ninth season because we don't know that yet. But put it into the universe.
No, I know.
Speak it.
I know. Your ratings are good.
When?
Your ratings are good. You're going another season.
It was definitely epic. And, you know, the cast, when I watch them, some like to blame editing, which is fine. But it's like, if we all just looked 5-star, like we wouldn't be 8 seasons in, you know? So just be like, thanks for making a great scene, even though I look like an asshole. Put it out. Mention it all.
Oh, you got the hands up again. You are fucking on fire today. Holy shit.
I am.
Yesterday you were like in a hole. Today you're like, boom, she's awake.
Boom, baby. Okay, bring on the virtual reunion. I'm about to slay these hoes. Just kidding. I cried a lot at the reunion.
Okay.
I cried a lot.
I have a question.
A lot of apologies.
I have a question. What was your favorite moment of Vanderpump this season and your worst moment of Vanderpump this season?
Oh,
And by the way, don't feel like any pressure to say me being on the show, but go ahead.
That was definitely a highlight. Having you on the show was a highlight because we got to hang out all summer.
It was awesome.
Which usually we don't get to do that. But I think that...
But yeah, what else besides me?
I'm going to get cheesy again. I think the highlight of this season was just being so clear and aware and waking up and not feeling guilty about anything I had done. You know, being sober, completing a season of reality TV, which can be a nightmare. I completed that shit sober.
And I give you mad props for that.
Thank you, babe.
I agree with you, and I support that answer. I love it. And what was the worst moment? Because I don't even know what your worst moment was. So what was the worst moment you would say?
The worst moment was the way I treated Raquel, for sure. Like, there are a few things that when I watch, I'm like, don't regret it. That, it was like, oh, la la, can someone please muzzle you? Like, you know? But it is what it is. Yeah. Like, again, silver lining, people were entertained. They had an opinion. Whether it was good or bad, people had an opinion.
By the way, that's what makes you, in my opinion, why your show is so successful, is all of you have this thing that happens, and then everybody just, you know, has an opinion because you drive people in what you guys do.
Yeah, when people write me crazy DMs, they're like, I can't believe you acted that way. Blah, 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 blah. All I send back is, thank you so much for watching, babe.
Oh, shit.
I, like, for real, without you, wouldn't be 8 seasons in, just saying. No. You know?
Well, I think the fact that I have never seen you have such conflict, right? Over the years I've been with you, where
you
had such conflict. And it be resolved in such an amicable and quick way. Like, normally, back in the old days, hence, you know, pre-sober, you would just assassinate the world, continue to assassinate, blow it up 3 more times, and then eventually start repairing. Now, I see you.
No, what I would do is blow things up, tornadoes come through, AK-47s, and then I'd look behind me and be like, why is everyone so sad and upset?
But now you handle things so gracefully. I really give you a lot of props. Like, something will happen, and then you'll get home and you'll be like, you know, I feel bad, and I really, you know, didn't want to do that, and blah blah blah. And then on your own, like, without cameras there, I see you sending texts saying, look, I really don't feel that way, and I'm sorry that I said something. It's just very genuine.
My cast members are not just my cast members. That's my LA family. Like, I love them so much. And I know that we're all always going to go toes with each other because we're all very strong personalities.
When you go toes, what does it mean exactly?
Step up, bitch.
Oh.
Go toes. Toe to toe, baby.
So if I'm in a meeting at a studio talking about a movie and the guy's pissing me off on a deal, can I be like, let's go to toes, bitch? I'm just asking.
You can.
Tim.
Yeah.
Not done that?
Oh.
But, yeah, right?
Tim goes, you have done that.
Well, I did it a little differently. The difference is, though, when I say let's go toes, if I know that that person really is a fighter, like, I don't want to do it. I'm a very fast runner. Like, let's fight with our words.
You'll back down, you mean?
Are you kidding me? Do I look like someone who's going to punch anybody?
So just tell me one thing.
I am a classy bitch.
Whoa, okay. Just tell me one thing, then. Tell me one thing. So in the 4 years when I've gone toes with you, how come you never back down?
Oh, and the drink. The drink is like the battery, you know? The drink is like a battery, the little fucking engine that could. We're getting up the hill.
But I, you know, it's funny. I talk shit, and you are a fighter if pushed in the wrong direction. But you know what? At the end of the day, you are way more of a lover than a fighter. Way more.
Of course. I always say, like, I hate confrontation, but I'm extremely good at it.
You're professional.
So I'm excited for our guest today, though, because I'm going to be honest. I looked at his resume and was like, am I up for this challenge? Like, he's, you know, graduating from Columbia. And I'm like, have you ever heard of Slick? Like, Salt Lake Community College up in this bitch.
I didn't know.
2 years.
Oh, shit.
Don't be rude.
Oh, shit.
I attempted.
You know, if I would have known this when I met you, I might have diverted in another direction.
And then I got all the credits I needed to transfer to the University of Utah.
Oh, you went to University of Utah?
Hardly.
Did you go for one day?
I went for like a month and I was like, going through from one class to another in the snow. And I like literally was like, what am I doing?
Can I give you a word of advice?
I hate this. I literally went home and was like, Mom, by the way, I'm moving to LA.
Can I give you a word of advice?
Tell me.
From now on, when we lead in about your education, can you just start with the University of Utah and just pretend the community college thing didn't happen?
This is who I am, Randall.
Oh, shit.
Are you crazy? Why would I ever?
I thought you went to Harvard.
Don't I act like it and sound like it?
Baby, anyway, I love you. No
thank
education.
You, honey. Hold on. Thank
so you. So we have Ben Mankiewicz, who is the host of Turner Classic Movies Channel, the host of Screen Time segment on CBS Sunday Morning Show. His father was press secretary to Senator Bob Kennedy. I mean, this guy is loaded to the gills. Now, I'm going to say something. I don't get impressed that easily. Takes a lot at my old age.
Right.
This guy is impressive.
Epic.
And by the way, I want to tell you, Lala, what really is putting us to the test, this next guest, this isn't like a movie guy that I can just kind of like sit back and have a cigar, or it's not a cast member of yours that you could just sit back and spill the tea, as you say. This dude is the real shit.
So we're either gonna, only is he like epic in his family. Randall, you're such a rookie. When Ben gets on the line, you better mute your phone.
Okay,
for real.
Can I say around. But this is what I want to say about this guest. I feel like the network threw this guest on us to see, are we ready for the next level? Yeah, because if we fuck this up, we have to go back to what we know, and we can never get outside our comfort zone. But if we crush this, and I want your fans and my three fans to write in after this episode and tell us, did we handle ourselves in a professional, engaging manner, or did we flop and we need to go back to what we both know?
Try to make the criticism constructive. I don't really respond well to people telling me I suck, you know?
Well, just give us advice. Like, did we handle ourselves well? Did we ask intriguing questions? Or were we boring and dismal? And
right? Yeah. I don't think that's ever going to be a problem. So let's take a short break. And when we get back, we have Ben Mankiewicz. I won't lie. Our guest is someone I read your resume, Ben, and I am extremely intimidated. And I don't get intimidated by many things. We have Ben Mankiewicz on our podcast today.
Yes.
I'm freaking out.
Ben, you're the man. I just want to say he is host of the new TCM podcast, The Plot Thickens, about the life and career of one of my favorite, most epic directors, Peter Bogdanovich. This is the coolest thing ever. I just want to know, Ben, how do you even come up with the idea to do that? Because now I want to go do a podcast about every epic director I've ever loved. Right? So can you just tell us like how that even started?
Well, many of them, of course, have lives that are worthy of being chronicled. But first of all, Peter and I were friends. And I liked Peter the first time I met him. I, as I tell the story in the podcast, I think in episode one, I was very nervous when I first met Peter. It was at an event, I think, in 2012 or 13 in Toronto, where we, in advance of the TCM Festival, we did some events around the country. I was in Toronto with Peter. We were going to screen The Last Picture Show. And because it's Peter Bogdanovich, the same reason that you admire him, I was nervous. This guy, he is an encyclopedia of classic movies. And I just thought, you know, the way all of us are frequently, where you sort of think that you've perpetrated any success you've had in life is because you've perpetrated some great fraud. And I thought he'd see right through me. but he had a cold, a pretty bad cold, and he was sniffling and drinking hot tea at this bar we met in the hotel. And, it humanized him instantly, and he made some joke. And then Sybil Shepherd, who he hasn't been linked to romantically since 1979, called him to check on him because she was worried about him traveling with a cold.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, listen, this guy's, he's still friends with his ex and he's got a cold, just like me. And that began a friendship. And then, so that's a long way of answering your question. Peter did all these wonderful interviews with classic film directors, Hitchcock, John Ford, Orson Welles, Howard Hawks, many others, including dating back to the silent era, before he became a director when he was a film writer, a very good one, wrote for Esquire magazine most frequently.
Oh, wow.
And he compiled them into a wonderful book called Who the Devil Made It, which is a great Howard Hawks line about how when you watch a movie, you should know who the devil made it. Like there should be some signature about the director, which you would be able to identify.
I like
And Peter
that.
Had recordings of these interviews, and I thought we should do a podcast. I wanted to do a podcast for years, and TCM was interested, but I was pushing, I must say, and I thought Peter would be a great topic. And we would, you know, spend each episode talking about one of these directors and play clips. And then professional storytellers took over, namely our executive producer for this podcast, Angela Carone. And they were like, yeah, that's a great idea. Here's what we're going to do instead with Peter. And they just made this whole thing 10,000 times better because Peter's life is a story worth telling, full of success, failure, horrible tragedy, hubris, wow. The normal parts of recovery from a tragedy. And it turned him into a different person. And he is an interesting guy, incredibly funny, incredibly smart, and I find now incredibly inviting and caring and thoughtful. So it worked out great. And Peter was so open with us and willing to tell his crazy, crazy Hollywood story.
Well, wow. It's absolutely fantastic. I found myself listening last night. It's very well done. And it's such a safe platform. So people just are feeling comfortable to tell it all. And I thought that it was, you know, the episodes that you have out are very well done. So again, that is The Plot Thickens, and it's about the life and career of Peter Bogdanovich. Amazing. And I have a question, because I know that, you know, you come from a background of journalism. I mean, your resume as far as education is incredible. What you've done, you know, in your career when you started as the reporter and anchor for WCSC-TV in Charleston. Like, when did you realize that news journalism wasn't really what you wanted to do?
Well, you know, first of all, I grew up a Jewish kid in Washington, D.C., you know, in sort of a middle-class to upper-middle-class upbringing. And you're like, well, I guess I'll go to law school. <You know? laughs> That's what we do.
Doctor, I'm a Jew from Miami. Well, or lawyer.
Yeah, the doctor, there was no chance of that. That is, I did not. I thought, you know, you can sort of, you know, I have these images of me in front of a jury, and I'm like, well, I can try to be charming in front of a jury, but you can't like be charming in front of a ruptured spleen. Like, I'd actually have to know what I was talking about. So I know what I was talking about. But I wasn't really into that. And my, you know, father was in politics and the media, and you know, he'd sort of been he was press secretary to Robert Kennedy. And
okay, whoa. Ben, real quick.
Yeah.
I heard that.
He just dropped that just like dropped it was that. Nothing.
But Ben, let me tell you something. The fact that your father was the press secretary to Senator Robert Kennedy, just explain what that was like for a minute, please. Because that's, sure. That's epic. Epic.
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, my dad, he died five and a half years ago, and he was 90, and he led this. He wrote a book called "So As I Was Saying," because every story my dad told is like in the middle of a story. Like, he would start and expect you to. He's like, you gotta have to catch up, like I did. And so I met, but that helped me tell the Peter story. That helps me in interviews, right? I mean, it helped me. Even though I'm talking a lot now, it helped me be a really good listener, which is definitely a strength that I have when I do these interviews. But my dad was the Latin American director of the Peace Corps, first Latin American director of the Peace Corps.
Wow.
And he met Senator Kennedy first in a phone call when the senator was going to come down to Peru and sort of figure out what was wrong with American foreign policy in Latin America. And he got this itinerary to, like, you know, go to the American language school and go to a party at the, you know, at the ambassador's house and tour the embassy. And my dad spoke up and he was like, yeah, look, man, you could do that from Washington. Like, that doesn't matter. You want to meet striking, you know, vegetable pickers, right? And you want to go through the barrios of people living in incredible poverty in Lima. And my dad was like, who's this guy? And said, can I meet you? I'm flying into Panama. Come meet me. And he was going to land in Panama to refuel at like 2:30 in the morning.
Oh,
so my dad went to Panama to meet him, and they met for like 3 hours. And Kennedy was like, look, whenever you're done here, come work for me. If you knew my dad, you would know that story. That makes total sense. He was just, my dad was always the smartest person in the room. And I don't, other people thought that too. So he hired him. He was the press secretary in the Senate, and then he ran for president. And then famously, you can see my father announcing the senator's death after he was when he was murdered.
So I have a question. So growing up with a father who was the press secretary, I mean, did you grow up going to the White House like it was like a regular thing?
No, of course. Well, obviously, as we well know, no, because as soon as I was of age, Richard Nixon was in the White House. So there was my dad very famously was on the White House enemies list, something he was very proud of till the till the day he died. He wrote two really good books on Nixon. His first book, which is a bestseller, was called Perfectly Clear. And then after Gerald Ford pardoned Nixon, my father wrote a book about what the prosecution of Nixon would have looked like.
Oh, my gosh.
Your dad's
my mind is blown. So then with, you know, your dad and what he was doing and his accomplishments, did you ever feel pressure to be on that same path? Did he kind of push that onto you in any way?
So my dad was as good a dad as you can get. So he never pushed anything onto me. He was great. He was supportive. I was a huge sports fan. He was very, you know, I wanted to go into sports. You know, when it became clear I couldn't play, I wanted to be, like a baseball broadcaster. That was sort of, but I was shy. And so it was hard for me to sort of do that. But I'd go to ball games and sit up in the, you know, behind home plate way up in the top deck. And I'd, you know, broadcast games into a tape recorder. And
oh, I love this.
So, and then my dad was president of National Public Radio, too, for 6 years. So journalism was just sort of in my blood. My brother is 12 years older than I am. He's a correspondent for Dateline, NBC. And so my brother sort of taught me how to be on TV and how to, you know, how to do all these things. I mean, he taught me how to be a reporter, which I was first. And so eventually when I sort of got and became less shy, I just sort of thought, well, I'll try and do what my brother does. But politics was always super important to me also because I grew up with it. I grew up in D.C. and I grew up in a family where
politics were very
prominent.
And they mattered. They weren't a game. They were about the future of the country and making people's lives better. Like that's how it always seemed to me. So I never had this cynical view of politicians. I thought many of the people who served most, and I think it's still true, most of the people who serve, they get into it because they
want to change the world.
Yeah, because my dad ran George McGovern's campaign in 1972. And so, you know, Robert Kennedy and George McGovern were these were guys who were in it for the right reasons, you know.
Wow.
It's really amazing to hear all of these things. And then, you know, you say, Ben, like, no, there was no pressure. We could do it. You know, like, it's pretty insane. You would think coming from that background that there would be tremendous pressure on you to kind of stay on the same path. I think that's really beautiful.
Well, okay, so now you think it won't be beautiful. My dad put no pressure.
Spill the tea.
My dad put no pressure on, but, you know, he's the person I admired most. And, you know, boys who love their dads and admire their dads,
you want to be like him.
I want to impress him. Yep. And the way to impress him was to try and be as smart as he is. And so eventually you just give up. Like, okay, he loves me anyway. That's good. But I can't fight this. I can't do it. So there was enormous pressure. You know, my grandfather and my great uncle, they, you know, won Oscars for, you know, my grandfather wrote Citizen Kane. And
right. Okay. So wait, Ben. Ben, you know what? But you know, I'm a movie nerd. Obviously, I've produced a lot of films. So I read this. Just take a beat on that. He co-wrote Citizen Kane. Come on. I mean, for me, that would thrust me into like movie anxiety at the highest level. So did you like, what was the takeaway you got being around, you know, this family that has epic Oscars and you know, writer Citizen Kane, the greatest movie of all time, period. Did you get anything out of, you know, that relationship?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's weird because my dad was this, mythic figure to me. But again, it was a totally normal dude. I mean, like, right. My grandfather, who Herman Mankiewicz, who by the way wrote Citizen Kane, he didn't co-write it. I know that it says he co-wrote it, but he.
Oh,
he
okay.
It. That was a source of great controversy. The writing credit for that, whether it's my grandfather's or Orson Welles. But it's a fun story.
We know all about
much about that.
We deal with that every hour.
And by the way, Peter's on the other side, Bogdanovich. So that's a fun conversation for me and Peter to have, a good natured conversation.
Oh, that's great.
And by the way, just real quick, it doesn't matter. It's Orson Welles' movie, and nobody should mistake that 100% his movie. He just didn't write it.
Right. This is great.
You know, but like, you know, it's like saying that, you know, I mean, Martin Scorsese didn't write the screenplay for The Irishman, but that's a Martin Scorsese movie and nobody should ever doubt that for a second. Right. So the Hollywood part of the family I knew about, of course, but it didn't mean.
The Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone senior writer Brian Hyatt.
Now here is my conversation with Jacob Knoll. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band and they must think this kid must have just been handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.